like to thank everyone for making it to come down today, and if everyone would like to put their hands together, and Andrew will introduce himself.
Thank you very much. Okay, thank you very much, JJ, for organising the event. Hopefully everyone can hear me okay, so it's quite a small room. If anyone would like to make a £3 donation to cover the costs, basically, of my petrol, that would be great. Hopefully the light, we've got a bit of light on the screen, unfortunately. I think we're going to be able to see it okay. It's a reflection from some brick, some tiling work out there, so it should disappear in the next few minutes, so we should be all right. I'll introduce myself a little bit more in a minute, but I'm going to start off with a little audio clip. I hope this plays. Let's try this.
Today we have with us a group of students among America's best. To you we say, we have only completed the beginning, and leave you much that is undone. There are great ideas undiscovered, breakthroughs available to those who can remove one of truth's protective layers.
So that's where I got the title of this presentation from Neil Armstrong, the first man who allegedly walked on the moon. So I'd like to start off by asking you to consider why you've come here today. Why have you actually come here? I'd like to thank everyone for coming. Thank you very much. It's great to see so many people have got an interest in this. And I'm not really going to do a, you know, ask you to raise your hands or ask you any, it's really just for you to think about inside your own mind, rhetorical questions. So did you come here? Did you come here by yourself, or did you come because somebody asked you to come? Do you have questions about what you see on TV and in the newspapers? Have you ever stopped to think, oh, that's not right? There's something going on there. Something really strange. Maybe you do. Maybe that's why you've come. Curiosity is the wick in the candle of learning. And that's what, ultimately, this is how, what drove me, is curiosity. Why is that like that? Why has that person said that? Why has that person reacted like that? That's what's driven me. What's that thing up there? I don't quite know what that is. That looks really weird. I need to find out more about that. Curiosity is the key. Curiosity is the key. That's by William Arthur Ward, saying there. So just a little bit about myself. Born and grew up in Yorkshire, and as you probably or may well know, if you don't, I'm going to tell you. You can tell a Yorkshireman, but you can't tell him much. I had a UFO sighting when I was about 10 or 11, and I was always interested in stuff like that, you know, ghost, paranormal. I knew that there was stuff in life that you come across which isn't spoken about, you know, very much. It's not in the textbooks. It doesn't really get fair coverage anywhere. So I knew all of that. I sort of studied sciences, and I grew up and went to sort of grammar school. Went to Lancaster University, did computer science and physics for 3 years. Finished there in 86. I then went on to work in what's called software engineering, which is basically coding, programming. And I did that with microelectronic systems, robotic systems, telecommunications. And I was doing that essentially up until 2009. In parallel with some of that, I got involved with teaching and education. I did a bit of adult basic education, helping people learn to read and write and stuff. I did that for a while. Then I got into full-time lecturing in 1993. But during my technical work, I was doing a lot of fault-finding, debugging, testing, that sort of thing. And then following that, really, I started to work at home. I was still doing some software at home as well. And ended up working for the Open University, which is what I do now. I work for the Open University part-time. It's all pretty much home-based. I go out and see students. So I'm my own boss, basically. My work is quite sporadic. Some weeks I have quite a lot of work, and some weeks I don't have so much. So on those weeks, I can go on the internet, and I can find out all this stuff, and I can make PowerPoints and all this kind of thing. So that's me when I was, I think, 11 or 12 in the very well-known 70s star jumper. So you should get an idea of my age from that. That's in Japan. That was a Toshiba control system that we're doing a bit of development work for. That was in Fuchi Works in Japan. I wasn't supposed to take a picture of that, but I did. But I got into this stuff. What's brought me here today, really, I began researching something called the Disclosure Project in 2003, which is basically about the UFO cover-up, and there is a cover-up relating to UFOs. I'm not talking about that tonight, but there is. And I knew there was a cover-up when I studied the Disclosure Project. And then we got broadband internet. That was in 2003, where I lived, just outside Derby. And I started a journey which has led me here tonight, essentially. So one of the underlying things, which you're not really taught about much, really, these days, not that much, is remembering to observe. Just look at things and think. Don't just accept what you're told. And as Marilyn Vos Savant said, to acquire knowledge, one must study, but to acquire wisdom, one must observe. So let's just try a bit of observation, shall we?
This is an awareness test. How many passes does the team in white make?
Apologies if it's not very clear, but you'll be enough to get the gist of it. Still got that light.
The answer is 13. But did you see the moonwalking bear?
So it's actually done to look out for cyclists. Again, unfortunately, because of the reflection we've got, we can't really close that curtain off either. But you can, I've brightened it up here, and this is actually just a still from the video. This is the moonwalking bear. And you can maybe get a better view of that online. But the point about it was, is you were asked to look for something. You were asked to look for the counting of the passes. And, you know, I think when I watched it, I think I got 11 or 12 or something. I missed one. But I did not see it. The first time I saw that, I never saw this guy in the costume sort of drifting through, and he's going, you know, he's going like this. So you have just seen how you're directed or cued to look for one thing, and most of you missed something fairly obvious. I did too when I was shown this. But it was in plain view. You can see it's right in the middle of the picture. The figure is, you know, he's not right at the back, he's in the middle of this group. They're passing the ball over him. This is what the mainstream media is doing for a large proportion of the time. They're putting all this stuff on about ISIS. They're putting all this stuff on about, you know, the austerity measures. All these things. The National Health Service being in trouble. We are encouraged or trained to focus on certain topics, issues and data whilst other things are going on. You have to look more closely to see what you are not supposed to see. Like, for example, Neil Armstrong talking about removing truth's protective layers. Ever seen that on the BBC? Probably not. Probably because it's never been shown. Now, tonight I'm going to be talking about various pieces of evidence relating to the moon landings on 9/11. I'm going to talk probably for about another hour or so, then we'll have a break, and then, you know, you can get a drink, go to the loo and things, have a fag, and then I'll do probably about another hour, and then do questions at the end. If you do want a quick question, if you've got a quick question, obviously feel free to interrupt, I don't mind, but if you can hold them to the end, it just flows a bit better. So I'm going to show you various bits of evidence. Keep focused on the evidence, right? You don't know me, you don't know who I am, I've told you a bit about myself, I could have made all that up, you know. So I'd like you to look at the evidence and see what you think of it. But if you go back, and, you know, say you've noted down some keywords that I say about Neil Armstrong or something, you could do a Google search for that, and you're bound to find a page that says, oh, that's bogus, that's been explained away, that's been debunked, oh, the guy that said that was a shill. All the conspiracy theories never amount to anything. That's what you hear. And this term conspiracy theory, well, I'm not going to talk about theories. I'm going to show you evidence, two different things. If you believe that, you're an idiot. That's you get various variations on that. You know, or, and the other one that I was having a conversation with tonight, Occam's razor. You just gotta use Occam's razor and you can rule out all that crap about moon landings. It's just all nonsense. I've never seen any evidence convincing me that XXX is true or that it happened that way. Or perhaps you've never looked for the evidence. That's why you've never seen it. And most or all cases, or you get, so-and-so's putting out disinformation, so you'll read things about me being a disinformation agent, or just, you know, you probably read various things about me and some of the people I'm going to talk about. And most or all cases where you find statements like this, they themselves, like they'll say, oh, that Andrew Johnson doesn't know what he's talking about. If you find that posted on the internet or something like that, many cases, that person that's posted that, you won't know their name. You won't know their qualifications. They don't go out and give public talks. You know, I'm here stood before a crowd of people. You can ask me questions. You could ask me anything. You know, but somebody on the internet that's behind a keyboard using a handle like, you know, Gravy, which I've seen people, you know, or D-Duck, are some of the forum posters that I've seen in the past. There's loads of them. You don't know who those people are. They could be in the US. They could be in Europe. They could be anywhere. They won't tell you anything about themselves. And if you ask them, they'll say, oh, you don't need to know that. Why are you asking me? Are you working for the intelligence services? No, but maybe you are. And Pete, they do, I can tell you that. Most people making these comments on Facebook, YouTube and forums are anonymous noise-generating posters who you cannot correspond with privately and you cannot find out more about. If anybody's got any questions after tonight and they don't either don't think of them tonight or they don't want to ask them in public tonight, write to me on my website, checktheevidence.com. I've got booklets, DVDs, leaflets, anything you want to know, you don't think of tonight, write to me. Ask me the question.
In the councils of government, we must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex. The potential for the disastrous rise of misplaced power exists and will persist. We must never let the weight of this combination endanger our liberties or democratic processes. We should take nothing for granted. Only an alert and knowledgeable citizen can compare the proper ratio of the huge industrial and military machinery of defense with our peaceful methods and goals, so that security and liberty may prosper together. Today, the solitary inventor, tinkering in his shop, has been overshadowed by testing in laboratories and testing fields. In the same fashion, the free university, historically the fountainhead of free ideas and scientific discovery, has experienced a revolution in the conduct of research, partly because of the huge costs involved. A government contract becomes virtually a substitute for intellectual curiosity. For every new blackboard, there are now hundreds of new electronic computers. The prospect of domination of the nation's scholars by federal employment, project allocations, and the power of money is ever present and is gravely to be regarded. Yet in holding scientific research and discovery in respect, as we should, we must also be alert to the equal and opposite danger that public policy could itself become the captive of the scientific, technological elite.
So I don't know if you're familiar with that speech. Maybe one or two people in this room might be. President Dwight Eisenhower, when he left office in 1961, referring to this military-industrial complex. A government contract becomes virtually a substitute for intellectual curiosity. The prospect of domination of the nation's scholars by federal employment, project allocations, and the power of money is ever present and gravely to be regarded. You know, it's quite sort of long-winded in some ways, but what was he talking about? He left office. Why wasn't he saying America is great? I've done a great job. I've left America in a wonderful state. What was he trying to tell people? Most people at the time didn't, this speech went, what is this guy on about? Yet he was the president. He was the president. What was he trying to tell us?
Sorry, what's his motivation? And they're all going to be put together and they're pre-selected. They know who's going to be from the prison. What was his motivation?
Well, that's a good question, isn't it? I mean, I can't honestly answer that. All I can do is give you my opinion on that. The fact that he said it is not in dispute, but why did he say it? And I think he was basically probably trying to do the right thing, and he realised that there were a lot of things which he'd come to know which were being kept secret. And the secrets were in the hands of people he thought weren't keeping those secrets for the best interests of humanity, basically. And so he was warning people that there was a lot of hidden power that, you know, needed to be thought about. And look what happened to the next president after Eisenhower. So I'm now going to talk about the moon landings, or lack thereof. Now, NASA, are they an example of, to use Eisenhower's phrase, a military industrial complex? Are they part of a military industrial complex? Are they a scientific technological elite? We look up to them, don't we? We think NASA, the great and the bold, they know stuff, everything that needs to be known about space. They're the elite. We bow down. Would you agree? I mean, obviously exaggerating slightly, but we look up to them, don't we? So we're now going to go on and look at Apollo. So we're first going to examine a range of evidence which I think proves that these landings were fake. They could not have landed on the moon with that technology that they claim to have used. We'll look at some aspects of the Apollo history, photographic evidence, video evidence. And you saw a very brief clip of what Neil Armstrong said right at the beginning there, which probably a few people have never heard that before. We're going to hear a couple more things like that. And we're going to look at some of the evidence from the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter, which is one of the newer moon probes, which went up, I think, in 2009, if my memory serves me correctly. But how could they have got away with it? We're going to ask that question. How could they have got away with faking a landing on the moon? Before I go into that, I'd like to thank these researchers. Most of the stuff that I've put together is derived from other researchers. I haven't done an awful lot of original research. I might have packaged it in an original way, possibly. But most of it has come from these people. Bill Kazing is now dead. Jim Collier's dead. Bart Chabelle, he's still doing stuff, posting stuff. He's done some excellent videos, which I'll mention. David Percy and Mary Bennett, written a book called Dark Moon. Ralph Rene, also deceased. He did a great book called NASA Moon America, very good book. So how could they possibly have got away with faking something like the moon landing? No way, no way. Some people will just laugh at you for even suggesting it. But I want to point out that not all of the program was faked. Not everything was faked. The common statement that kind of assumes that the whole program was faked, only parts of it were faked though, as you'll see. Most researchers will likely agree that the Apollo rockets were real and they took off. The capsules probably took the astronauts into orbit. Some people even dispute that. Some people, Bill Kazing, for example, who worked for Rocketdyne, he thinks they never even got into orbit. He thinks they all stayed on the ground. With this in mind, much of the effort in the program was taken up with actually getting the rockets off the ground, getting them into space. Remember, this is 1960s technology. Serious rocketry was only about 30 years old, something like that, 25, 30 years old, that sort of time. Once the capsule was aloft, there was only one source of video and photo information, and that was NASA. So all the images, all the photographs, all the videos, they came from NASA. Only NASA was communicating with the astronauts. Now, we had a few radio hams who were listening in to some of the communications, allegedly, but they didn't actually have access to any of the photographs or anything like that. Most people at NASA would never have considered that they were involved in something that was being hoaxed. They would never question what was on the screen in front of them. They were maybe monitoring one part of one system. And they'd run through thousands of simulations or hundreds of simulations beforehand. How would they know that they weren't watching one of their simulations and not the real thing? So think about it in those terms. So let's just have a look at a bit of the Apollo 2 history, because as you'll see, the problems actually started pretty early on. Paperclip von Braun and the rocket could not be built. The paperclip conspiracy was revealed in the 1980s, and it was a plan to import Nazi rocket scientists into the US American rocketry program following their work in the Second World War. That's where these rocket scientists came from Germany, just about all of them. Was this a healthy pedigree, do you think, coming from Nazi Germany with all the atrocities that they revolved in there? But what people, again, this is almost never brought up. You'll very rarely hear this discussed in any of these documentaries on TV about the moon hoax. It is commonly, in fact, I think I've got this in the clip, so I'm not going to read it out. This is from Wernher von Braun's book. He talks about the Apollo rocket would need to be, let's see, taller than the Empire State Building, a quarter of a mile high.
Under Adolf Hitler's leadership, on Nazi war criminals, Wernher von Braun built thousands of V-2 rockets through slave labor that were launched against London.
Once the rockets are up, who cares where they come down? That's not my department, says Wernher von Braun. Some have harsh words for this man of renown, but some think our attitude should be one of gratitude.
After the war, the Soviets and the Americans divided up the rocket technology. The Americans brought home over 100 top Nazi propulsion specialists, including their leading rocket scientist, von Braun.
Say rather that he is apolitical.
Since most people wanted to come live in America, the Soviet Union was given most of the hardware, which, to a large degree, contributed to their victory with Sputnik. By 1961, Nazi rocket scientists such as von Braun maintained a close relationship with President John F. Kennedy as he moved to fulfill his promise to land Americans on the moon before the end of 1969. Yet today, NASA says it will be 2018 before we go back to the moon, despite having supposedly been there over 35 years ago. In 1953, von Braun wrote a book on how to get to the moon, titled Conquest of the Moon. On page 14 of his book, he states, "It is commonly believed that man will fly directly from the Earth to the moon, but to do this, we would require a vehicle of such gigantic proportions that it would prove an economic impossibility. It would have to develop sufficient speed to penetrate the atmosphere and overcome the Earth's gravity, and, having traveled all the way to the moon, it must still have enough fuel to land safely and make the return trip to Earth. Furthermore, in order to give the expedition a margin of safety, we would not use one ship alone, but a minimum of three. Calculations have been carefully worked out on the type of vehicle we would need for the non-stop flight from the Earth to the moon and return. The figures speak for themselves. Each rocket ship would be taller than New York's Empire State Building, 1,250 feet, and weigh about 10 times the tonnage of the Queen Mary, or some 800,000 tons. The Apollo program's three-stage Saturn V was only 3,000 tons. The Saturn V was 266 times smaller than it had to be.
So the Saturn V was 266 times smaller than it had to be. That's not like half the size, or 266 times too small, according to von Braun's own statements. Von Braun was the main rocket scientist. Now, I'd be surprised if any people in the room have heard about that from his own book. Now, Gus Grissom, he was meant to be the first man on the moon. He was regarded as a loose cannon, and he had first-hand knowledge that the space program was in a shambles. This was in the mid-60s. There's no telling what he might say. In fact, he called a press conference. If you watch this film that I had that clip from just then, called Apollo Zero, you'll hear more that Gus Grissom was so, you know, concerned about the state of the Apollo program, he called a press conference and said, look, these guys are just in a shambles. We're never going to get there. And what he did was, Grissom made a brief stop at home before returning to the Cape. A citrus tree grew in their backyard with lemons on it as big as grapefruits. Gus yanked the largest lemon he could find off the tree. Betty, that's his wife, had no idea what he was up to and asked what he planned to do with the lemon. I'm going to hang it on that spacecraft, Gus said grimly, and kissed her goodbye. Minutes before he and his crew died, he complained, "I can't hear a word you're saying." Gus said in disgust, "Jesus Christ," I said, "how are you going to get to the moon if we can't even communicate between two or three buildings?" That's what he said.
The leading astronaut of the day, Gus Grissom, was slated to be the first man to walk on the moon. He was an outspoken man with the highest level of integrity. There was no way he would lie for anyone. He was also an outspoken critic of the dilapidated state of the moon program. Just before he died, he hung a lemon on the capsule and held a press conference in which he pointed out the sad state of the program. On the morning he died, upon having difficulty communicating from the capsule, he angrily asked,
"How are we going to get the moon? We can't talk to these three buildings."
And in 1967, during a plugs-out test in which no engines were even ignited, they had him in a sealed capsule and pressurized it with 100% pure oxygen. A fire erupted, and all three astronauts perished. After this grisly incident, no other astronaut dared to criticize the program. And after all these years of lying and making their livings off of fame, none chooses to wreck this acclaimed success for the others by telling the truth. There is strong reason to doubt the fire was accidental. Page 81 of the Apollo 1 Accident Investigation Report, issued by the U.S. Congress, reveals that prior to the fire, NASA, by their own admission, were very well aware of the respective fires at the Johnsville Navy Air Station and Brooks Air Force Base. The fires in question, as pointed out by author Ralph Rene, were a result of sparks and even static electricity igniting the pure oxygen environments. In spite of these past fatalities, NASA used a 100% oxygen atmosphere in the Apollo 1 spacecraft, arguing that they had done it previously on the Gemini program. Of course they had. However, Gemini had a cabin pressure of only 3 pounds per square inch, the pure oxygen equivalent to the 14.7 pounds of nitrogen and oxygen at sea level. All previous aviation flash fires have been only slightly higher than Gemini's cabin pressure. Apollo 1's cabin pressure was more than 5 times higher. NASA was aware of the dangers, but they went ahead and sealed 3 of their astronauts inside a highly volatile capsule that had already been packed full of combustible and highly toxic materials, most of which were untested and had not been given their seal of approval before they were installed. The technicians on Pad 34 needed at least 5 minutes to open the command capsule's door. The astronauts had a mere 15 seconds before the fire consumed their cabin. Additionally, in 1999, when Grissom's son, Scott, was granted access to his father's spacecraft, he uncovered evidence that a metal plate had been shoved behind the dashboard to deliberately trigger a spark. Keep in mind that many of these scientists were war criminals imported from Hitler's Germany. One should not be surprised that such horrors could occur when one considers that these Nazis helped perpetuate the cruelest, most brutal atrocity that has ever taken place in the history of mankind.
So imagine the conversation with Neil Armstrong. "Neil, Gus has been killed. Now, I'm giving you a choice. You can be the most famous man in the world, or, you know, something like what happened to Gus Grissom could happen to you. What choice are you going to make?" So they had the whole thing pretty well sewn up early on in the program, I think, that they knew what was going to unfold, and the people in it probably knew what was going to unfold, and so they covered all the bases that they needed to cover. So I'm now going to look at some of the evidence. We've got some circumstantial evidence there that, you know, they were going for a cover-up from early on in the program. Now, again, we've still got a bit of a problem with the light. It should be better in the second half, but I think you should hopefully be able to see this well enough. Now, what I've done here is there's a site called allist.com, and there's these two images here with the lunar module and the backdrop here, and you can see that if you look at these two images here, we've got a very similar sort of look with a backdrop, and the camera angles are the same, you'll see in a minute. but the Lamb appears to move. In this shot, you can't see it. You'll see it in the large section in a minute. But the Lamb is right over here. This is the lunar excursion module, the lunar lander thing. And here it's in the foreground. Well, let's have a look. So there's the Lamb. Here's all the hills in the background. You've got the foreground dusters moving around and stuff. How is this possible? How is this possible? You've got, that means you've got to actually, this is actually a composite of four shots, like a panorama joined together. This means that you've got to get the same orientation of the camera pointed the exact same section, you know, not just angled off slightly, in these two shots. How is this possible?
Why do they give such a bad job of it? Because this is the top.
You don't notice it. You don't notice it. Unless you do this overlay, you wouldn't notice it.
They must have realised that they switched off in certain people.
Oh, they do. They do know that. But it's not enough. You know, they can get away with it. But yeah, you're right. And again, to go into more detail on this, I came across this quite recently, although it was done in 2012. This parallax study. Does everyone know what parallax is? This is where you look at something, and you can see it in the distance, and then you move, and you see it in a slightly different position, because of the distance you are from the object. So you see with, in fact, again, we're going to need a better clue. We're going to see it on a larger version in a minute. But basically what they did was, there are some of the Apollo shots where the astronauts have only moved about 10 metres, 5 metres, but they've pretty much got the same backdrop. And you can work out the distance to the images, to the objects in the backdrop from parallax. There's a formula which is given here. So this Russian guy, he took some of the original Apollo 15 photographs, and then he worked out the parallax on them and worked out the different distance. In fact, this is an example. This is Jim Lovell standing at the rear of the rover, just here. Again, we've got a larger version of this in a minute, so you'll hopefully see this a bit better. The Apennine front and the crater St. George are located in the background, so he's located where all these things are, allegedly on the moon. The distance from the camera to the lunar module and rover is about 10 metres, and the Apennines and the crater should be 4 to 8 kilometres away. But you can see here, this is the two photographs overlaid with one another, so you've got basically things in pretty much the same place, and you should see a certain change in the backdrop, but you don't. The backdrop is identical. So from this study, and he didn't just study these images, you can look at this on the website that he's done. Subtraction of the two photos after transformations of scaling, rotation and distortion is shown on the left. The right image shows the parallax achieved after merging the two frames. And his conclusion, I won't read it all out, this finding indicates that it is less than 300 metres to the background, the mountains, instead of 5 kilometres. It's a huge difference. In addition, the Apollo 15 stereoscopic photos feature a clear separation line between the mountains and the foreground. Based on the distance between the camera and the rover, a distance to the panorama of the lunarscape cannot be more than 150 metres. So according to NASA, these are like, you know, whatever, 5 kilometres away. According to the parallax, they're only 150 metres away in a studio. And he's done this not just with that image, but he's done about 10 or 12 different ones. And he's done similar calculations. So they must have been taken in a studio. And he actually worked out the curvature of the dome, because he said it was a domed studio. And he can work out from some of the other images what the curvature of that dome was. So you can see there, for that line with the parallax, you can see that, again, we've got a problem with the light, but you can just see there's this line here. You can see that line moving, but there's no movement behind that. There's a very distinct cutoff there, right there. Oh, this is a larger version. Yeah, you can see it a bit more clearly now. So you can see there's very little sort of change behind this line. So it looks like there, or just beyond there, that's where the edge of the studio is, and this is a back projection. You can see there's this weird movement here, which shouldn't really be happening. And it's not just a problem with the shadows and the parallax. You'll read a lot about all the shadows are all explained if you just, you know, no, they're not. But I'm not going to talk about the shadows. I'm going to talk about this particular image here. And again, I've been criticised the way I've talked about this, but I'll explain that in a moment. This is a genuine photo on a fake moon, right? This is an impossible photograph of astronaut Charlie Duke. If you want the actual NASA image number, it's AS-16 from Apollo 16, 117-18841. You can go and Google that image and find this image on NASA's database. With an average temperature of over 100 degrees centigrade on the moon's surface, in daylight, the photo would curl up almost immediately.
So here we have a primary photograph, and over here we have another, and this oven is set to 100 degrees centigrade, and I'm now going to put this photograph in the oven, just cooking some of my dinner, and then I'm going to watch it through the lights. And you can see that in very short order, trying to get better light, you'll see when I open it, this is curling up within seconds. So I think that's a pretty convincing demonstration. And here it is. You can see it there curled up, and that's only 100 degrees centigrade.
So, I mean, I was obviously able to reach in and bring that out. It wasn't very hot. It's probably only 60 degrees, because I was only in there for a couple of minutes. Now, people have criticised me because that's obviously done in air. That's, you know, in the air. Whereas on the moon, there's no air. And people would claim that that makes a difference. But I say it doesn't make no difference, because you're getting radiation from the sun directly onto that photograph with nowhere for the heat to be convected away from. So you've no convection, because there's no gas on the moon. There's no atmosphere, or it's a very tiny atmosphere. And you've got this hot ground behind it. When it's put down, this thing would shrivel up. The plastic's not even shriveled, for heaven's sake. So just from the temperature alone, there is no possible way that that photograph can be on the surface of the moon. Yet that is on NASA's website. That photograph cannot be on the surface of the moon. End of. No debate, as far as I'm concerned. People will try and debate with me, but I think there's no possible way, because of the heat, that would curl up. So now we're going to go, people have said, oh, well, you know, you must be able to see things left on the moon. I'll get to the mirrors in a minute. That's the one that always comes up. I haven't put a slide in about that, but I will mention it. So can't we see the Apollo landing craft with the Hubble Space Telescope? Surely we must be able to see them. But before we do that, in fact, well, you can't actually see them. I think I've taken those slides out because of the time. You can't see the, according to the Hubble's resolution, you cannot see the Apollo craft on the moon with the Hubble Space Telescope, according to the published figures. I worked that out. It's to do with the resolving power. You can't see it. So we'll look at Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter, which I mentioned earlier on. LRO was launched, and the objectives of the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter are to find safe landing sites for future crewed missions, locate potential resources, characterise the radiation environment, and demonstrate new technology. LRO was launched on June 18, 2009 by an Atlas rocket from Cape Canaveral Air Force Station. It was one of two payloads carried by the rocket, the other being the Lunar Crater Observation and Sensing Satellite LCROSS. So this is a picture of the probe, an artist's impression of the probe. Now, what you can see here is one of the pictures which was released, I think, in 2011 on NASA's website with great fanfare. And it said that this here was the Apollo 11 landing site where they landed for the first time on the moon. And this is it. This is the image. This white blob with four smaller white blobs around it. That's meant to be the Lunar Excursion Module on NASA's website. Right? Again, I can get anybody that wants the links to these to find them for themselves. Just contact me and I'll send them the actual links. Particularly as, again, we've still got this slight problem with the sunlight. Now, what I did was, you can work out how big that should have been. Because they give you a scale, right? They give you a scale on this image here. They say that is 200 metres. So you can work out how big that is. And what you work out is that it's 25 by 25 pixels, right? So this here, if you zoom into the full size image, it should be 25 pixels by 25 pixels. So what I did was, I made sure that when I zoomed into that image, this is 25 pixels by 25 pixels. So that's meant to be the lunar excursion module, right? From NASA's own image from 2011. Or was it 2009. But this is meant to be NASA's image filmed with a new probe from orbit. That's it. That's Apollo, folks. Stop talking about moon landing hoaxes because there's the pictures. Really? Really? Well, let's have a fair comparison to this, because what I found was, this is a picture of the lunar module in an orbital test. It was docked in orbit. They did some docking procedures, allegedly. And this was taken from the command module. And you can see we haven't got quite got a top view. You know, we've got a fairly good top view. So that was a high-resolution picture. You can download that. There's the image reference. So what I did was I just took that out, cropped that out, and I converted that down to 25 pixels by 25 pixels, right? And you can see that little bit of brown there. You can see there's this. You see a little bit of variation of colour, bit of reflection there, look. So you've got variation. So that's really what you should be seeing on the surface of the moon, something similar to that. But you can't, you just see this white blob. Now I want to put a little psychological question to you. Just say, for example, that I'd come home with that picture, and I says, oh, I've just been out, you know, for a microlight ride or a helicopter ride or something, and I saw this UFO landed on the ground, and I took a picture with my phone camera or my digital camera. Look, I photographed it. Would you believe, could you tell anything from that picture that what I saw was a flying saucer or whatever? How much could you tell? Pardon?
Sorry, I'd say bollocks.
Yeah, yeah. I would say bollocks as well. But that's NASA's proof. Now, I have to say they've added more images since. They had more passes of LRO, and they've apparently got better images now on their website of Apollo 16, I think, and Apollo 12. They've imaged some of the other landing sites, and the images do look more convincing. They actually look more like this. Right? So you will find other ones, but these are some more Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter images. This is meant to be the lunar rover here, this thing here. You're telling me that became that? Now, let's compare these to images you can get either via Google Earth or GeoEye. There's a site called GeoEye, which is an orbital satellite. GeoEye is 423 miles above the Earth, travelling at 4 miles per second, 17,000 miles an hour. So it's comparable to what Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter is doing around the Moon. All right, and its LRO's orbit was 50 miles above the surface when that picture was taken that I just showed you. And there's no atmosphere. This is one of the pictures that you can get from GeoEye. This is a car here. And you can actually see a bit of the bonnet, the roof, etc. If you look at that closely, you can sort of differentiate the different parts of the car. And it's in colour. Get a good colour reproduction. That's not a NASA satellite. That's privately owned. So if you can get that with a privately owned satellite, I'm sure NASA can do a bit better. Now, Gerard White, who's done a lot of analysis of these images, he's done a good analysis of this. He will go through all of this evidence much better than I can in here. Gerard White, Moonfaker on YouTube. So we have this comparison then. This is a GeoEye image, and you don't get all this mush and these vertical grey lines and crud and mush that's in this image. So compare them. Why are these images so crap from NASA? Why? Some people are perfectly happy with them. I'm not.
Of all the footage of Apollo 11 requested from NASA over a five-year period, one gem was discovered just before the completion of this documentary. An old reel received by mistake. It contains the raw or unedited footage of the crew of Apollo 11, Michael Collins, Edwin Aldrin Jr., and Neil Armstrong, staging part of their mission for nearly an hour in living color, with exceptionally clear behind-the-scenes audio of conversations discussing the techniques used to achieve a disingenuous picture depicting the Earth at a distance, in order to falsely demonstrate their far journey from it and their ability to survive passing through the Van Allen radiation belts. It cannot be misconstrued that this staging was done for some other reason prior to the mission, for the reel itself is slated and dated July 18th, 19th, and 20th, 1969, the very days of the mission when they were said to be approaching and achieving lunar orbit. Furthermore, it is apparent they are in genuine zero gravity aboard the actual spacecraft, necessary to convince the mass media of their authenticity, just not any further than Earth orbit, as you will see. In this never-before-seen or heard footage, not only is the radio conversation between the astronauts and Houston Control audible, there is a secondary, private conversation taking place between the crew and a third confidential party, prompting the astronauts with what to say, when to speak, and how to effectively manipulate the camera to achieve the desired misleading effect. NASA claims that the Houston transmissions were the only ones taking place for the astronauts. Listen now as Houston Control initiates a conversation with the crew, only to find them too preoccupied with the behind-the-scenes trickery to respond. Moments pass, and the oversight is picked up on by the clandestine third party, who quickly prompts them with talk. Immediately, Neil Armstrong speaks. Again, the illusion they are attempting to create is the Earth at a distance to demonstrate their far journey from it and their ability to survive passing through the Van Allen radiation belts. Understand, too, that only about 20 seconds of this raw footage was ever broadcast to the public, and these conversations discussing their deception were believed to be private until now. Here they discuss that these television transmissions were in fact not broadcast live as everyone believed. They were first screened and edited for playback later.
We just wanted a Mindy such a weekend when we get to playback, we can sort of correlate what we're seeing. Thank you very much.
Here they discuss the fact that they have turned out the lights and have blocked out sunlight from entering the spacecraft through the other windows as to not cause any reflected light to fall onto the spacecraft's wall in the foreground.
Okay, very good. Well, we shut out, it's not coming in from the spacecraft, so it's plugging through
the reason this was done is so that the truth of the matter would not be revealed. It is this. Though the federal government would have you believe that this is a view of Earth from a distance out of the spacecraft's window as it nears the moon, it is not. What they have ingeniously done is placed the camera at the back of the spacecraft and centered the lens on a circular window in the foreground, outside of which it is completely filled with the Earth in low orbit. The circumference of the window then appears to be the diameter of the Earth at a distance, with the darkened walls of the spacecraft appearing to be the blackness of space around it. That is why they wanted the interior dark and blocked out the sun from entering through the other windows. Here you can see the extruded window, probably 2 inches thick at the bottom. This is because the Earth's shine is coming in at a downward angle. It also causes the Earth to appear to be an irregularly shaped circle, for you are seeing the outside of the window at the bottom and the inside of the window at the top, which together form 2 different sized halves of a circle. Subsequently, this tape was never used. As they perfected the shot, a crescent-shaped piece of black material was inset slightly into the window to create the illusion of the Earth's terminator line dividing night and day. It is uncannily convincing. During this segment, intended to be edited and played back later for the worldwide television audience, dated July 18th, 1969, Neil Armstrong condemns himself as he states that he is 130,000 miles out, or halfway to the moon, as the NASA flight log also states on this date, when he is in reality in low Earth orbit of a few hundred miles. Here, during another segment, also intended to air after review, Neil Armstrong falsely explains to the viewers how the shot is attained by putting the camera's lens to the window's glass, as it would have to be if they were the claimed distance away from the Earth.
We only have one window that has a view of the Earth, and it's filled up with a TV camera.
If the window was completely filled up with a TV camera, as he stated, then an astronaut's arm would not be able to get between the camera and the window, as it obviously does here in this outtake.
North America becomes invisible just off beyond the equator or inside the shadow.
You can also notice how the astronaut operating the camera reacted to the mistake by attempting to pan away from it. This is a segment that they believed wasn't even being recorded, much less suitable for broadcast, for the lens was being zoomed out and the scene was being changed to that of the interior of the astronauts at work, and apparently the stop button popped back up on the recorder without notice. Here is the diffused work light that they used to see camera controls, but not throw light onto the spacecraft's wall. Here they remove part of the crescent insert. Finally, the iris is opened up, and you can see the real location of the camera and the very bright and near Earth out the window. Here is the slate for the 19th of July, and the same shot of trickery on the 19th of July, and then the 20th, and the same misleading shot on the 20th. Later that evening, they were said to be walking on the moon. How can this be when they were in Earth orbit only 9 hours earlier, and the moon is some 3 days' journey away? Furthermore, if they genuinely went to the moon, why would they be faking any part of it? Why this trickery with the window? By faking being halfway to the moon, it becomes apparent that they did so because they could not even go halfway. It thus confirms that the stumbling block to their success was the lethal radiation of the Van Allen radiation belts. Since the same equipment was used on the subsequent missions in the 40 months that followed, none of them could have gone to the moon. They only increased their proficiency at staging them.
So why would they be faking the shot? Why are they in the spacecraft filming this Earth at a distance? Why would they be doing that? Again, that I think has been shown on the television once or twice, but it's just, it's not analysed, it's not studied, it's not discussed. If it even has. So, for more video evidence, you can watch What Happened on the Moon, which is David Percy and Mary Bennett's film. That's, I think, on YouTube. It's about 4 hours long. There's Was It Only a Paper Moon? And that clip I played there came from A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Moon, which is Bart Sobrell's film. Now, there are other physical and hardware problems with what they allegedly got to the moon with. I'm not going to spend too much time on things like the radiation because, for example, you'll get these circular arguments where Van Allen, he discovered the radiation belts with an experiment, I think, in 1962, I think it was. Was it 59? I can't remember the exact date. And lethal radiation belts, and it was said no one could pass through them because there's too much radiation, it would be lethal to a human. You couldn't go beyond the distance out that they are. And then when they, after the moon landings, or alleged moon landings, Van Allen said, oh well, they can't have been as bad as I thought they were because they went through them. So it becomes a circular argument. Now, considering the radiation levels on the moon, nobody disputes that. protections that the astronauts had do not seem adequate compared to what is used, for example, people working at an x-ray machine in a hospital. You have to wear a lead apron. The astronauts didn't have such things. They didn't have lead-lined suits. It would have been too heavy. It would have been too heavy to actually take in the spacecraft. Obviously, when they wear them in the reduced gravity, it wouldn't have been as heavy. They were still quite heavy, though. Others have noted problem with travelling through the Van Allen belts. We've talked about that. And then these radiation effects, they've actually been seen in the space shuttle. It was reported by some of the space shuttle crew that they would see flashes in their eyeballs with their eyes closed. And these were cosmic rays which were interacting with the aqueous and the vitreous humour in your eyeballs and causing these little flashes. So you got these little flashes even when you were asleep. And that's in low Earth orbit. So you're getting radiation even at that level. And why didn't the film get fogged? The cameras that they used weren't special cameras. And the film that they used wasn't special film. Yet we got perfect pictures. Jim Collier has also noted that the lunar excursion module space is too small to climb in and out of in a spacesuit without breaking something on the control panel, if you look at how the thing's set up. The lunar rover, even when folded, seems to have been too big to fit in the allocated space, and dust did not fly up high enough during rover runs. If you watch these, the dust doesn't fly up very high. And not only that, additionally, what about the air cooling conditioning on the LEM and in the spacesuits? Now imagine leaving your car in a car park on a hot sunny day for an hour. You close the windows. It's about 22 centigrade outside. When you get in the car, it'll be too hot and you will either open the window, a door, or switch on the air conditioning. Everyone's done that. But that's on the Earth, that's here. Where you've got, you can use air to cool it. Can't do that on the moon, no air. How do you keep things cool? Can't do it. How are the spacesuits cooled? And the other thing, amusing thing that somebody sent to me, what about going to the toilet? What do you do with the waste? And if you work out the amount of waste they would have generated during those 4 days of mission or whatever it was, it adds up to quite a lot of waste fluid.
One thing I noticed, that picture in the bottom right, having a really crisp pictures. And then
perfect. Yeah, I agree. And again, another one which I don't think I've put a slide in for, but if you work out the total number of images that were taken in all the Apollo missions and then add up the total number of hours they were on the surface, which I forget the exact figures, but you can easily find this, and you divide the total number of pictures by the total time, they've been taking picture-perfect shots about, once every minute or something. Something like that. And they've got to do all those experiments, allegedly, as well. Somebody wrote to me about this, the battery in the lunar rover. You can actually find out the battery specification. The survival upper limit for the battery is 140 Fahrenheit or 60 degrees centigrade. This meant the lunar rover would not have worked for very long at all, I would argue. In the day, the temperature on the moon averages at 107 Fahrenheit, which is 107 centigrade, which is 220, that's the average, 224 Fahrenheit. Although it rises as high as 123 centigrade, that's 253 Fahrenheit. Now, according to this same manual, the rover has cooling fins, which, again, allegedly would cool this. But again, they can't cool by convection. They can only cool by radiation. There's no air. So I would argue that this thing couldn't have worked. According to their own specifications, they couldn't have cooled it. Apparently they wrap it in aluminium foil or something, but there's no way. And the other thing with the lunar rover, how would they attach it? They attached it to the bottom of the lunar module on one side. So if you've got this heavy weight of a few hundred pounds of lunar rover on one side, how are you going to land the thing safely without it toppling over? It wasn't in the middle. There's all kinds of problems. Now, I might skip over some of these clips here because I've been going for nearly an hour, so I'm probably going to skip through some of this. Here are some clips of what Buzz Aldrin has said. I'm not going to play the clips, but he basically said, you're talking to the wrong guy. We're just passengers, guys going on a flight. He didn't say to the moon. And Bart Sobrell confronted him with this. He didn't say on a flight to the moon. He said they were just passengers. He said they should talk to the administrator of NASA about the issue. Well, surely Aldrin knows whether he meant to the moon or not. I won't play that clip, it's a bit long. Now.
Mr. Aldrinall?
I'll play this one.
Mr. Aldrinall, I always wanted to ask you this. We saw the photos of the little Masonic flag to the moon and some of the names of the missions and the numerology. Is there anything to that? Or what is the Masonic influence? We know there's Masonic influence in the founding of the country. What is the Masonic influence on NASA?
As far as I can tell, zero. There were some Masonic brothers of mine in Texas that wanted me to take some kind of a Masonic emblem to the moon in some gesture of, I don't know what it would be a gesture of, but I told them that it was not within my my authority to do such a thing.
So he denied taking any Masonic emblems or symbols or whatever to the moon. Funny, because in this letter that he wrote, this is a copy of the letter, he writes, Dear Grand Commander, so this is to one of his lodges, it was a great moment in my life to be so cordially welcomed to the House of the Temple on September 16th, 1969 by you and Grand Secretary General Kleinkrecht. 33, and also members of your staffs. My greatest pleasure, however, was to be able to present to you on this occasion the Scottish Rite flag, which I carried on the Apollo 11 flight to the moon. So he told Alex Jones he didn't take anything of Masonic nature to the moon. Nobody asked him. But he said in this letter that he did. The guy's a liar. He's lying. And there are other clips of Aldrin as well, which bear closer inspection. And he's also made a lot of money out of the moon landings. He auctioned off a note that he wrote in a spacecraft for $11,000. Just a little note that he'd written about, you know, something on the mission.
Sir Armstrong, I do realize that when you were on the moon, you may have very little time for gazing upwards. But could you tell us something about what the sky actually looks like from the moon? Sun, the Earth, the stars are heavy, and so on.
The sky is deep black when viewed from the moon, as it is when viewed from cislunar space, the space between the Earth and the moon. The Earth is the only visible object other than the sun that can be seen, although in some reports I've seen planets. I myself did not see planets from the surface, but I suspect they might be visible. The Earth is quite beautiful from space, and from the moon. It looks quite small and quite remote, but it's very blue and covered with white lace of the clouds, and the continents are clearly seen, although they have very little color from that distance.
What about the sun? Do you see any trace of the corona?
No, the glare from the sun on the helmet visor was too difficult to pick out the corona. The only time we could see the corona was during eclipse of the sun from the moon. That is when we were flying through the moon's shadow and could observe the solar corona peeking out from behind the moon.
Thank you, Mr. Vice President, Mr. President, members of Congress, fellow astronauts, ladies and gentlemen. Wilbur Wright once noted that the only bird that could talk was the parrot, and he didn't fly very well. Today we have with us a group of students among America's best. To you we say, we've only completed the beginning. We leave you much that is undone. There are great ideas undiscovered, breakthroughs available to those who can remove one of truth's protective layers. places to go beyond belief.
Mr. Armstrong, Bart Sibrel, ABC Digital. I wanted to give you the opportunity to swear on the Bible that you walked on the moon. Will you put your left hand on the Bible and swear to God that you walked on the moon?
Jim, Mr. Sibrel?
Yes. If you really walked on the moon, why don't you not do that? So why don't you just put the end to the record and the argument and put your hand on the Bible, swear to God you walked on the moon?
Mr. Sibrel, do you know that's probably a fake Bible?
Well, no, it's a real Bible. You have the opportunity to get $5,000.
With the meaning, it's
well, you have $5,000 cash. You can give it to charity. You can swear on the Bible like you walked on the moon. Ivan Tater, why don't you swear to... Why not? Why won't you do it? So why don't you put your hand on the Bible and swear to God that you walked on the moon?
Mr. Sibrel must be a fool of himself in front of the world. Mr. Sibrel, you do not deserve answers.
The pictures that came back were quite remarkable. What did it look like to you, to your naked eye?
It's a brilliant surface in that sunlight. The horizon seems quite close to you because the curvature is so much more pronounced than here on Earth. It's an interesting place to be in. I'd recommend it.
He said once to a reporter, how long must it take before I cease to be known as a spaceman? Why did you make that comment?
I guess we all like to be recognized not for one piece of fireworks, but for the ledger of our daily work.
Strolling around the Ohio farm where he was born, Armstrong is easy to talk to, but hard to know. He can seem guarded, but above all, we were struck by his humility.
You sometimes seem uncomfortable with your celebrity, that you'd rather not have all of this attention.
No, I just don't deserve it.
But look, how many people have walked on the moon?
12.
You were the first. You were chosen to do that. That's special.
Yeah, I wasn't chosen to be first. I was just chosen to command that flight. Circumstance put me in that particular role. That was the plan by anyone.
After Apollo 11, Armstrong hung up his spacesuit and never felt the need for an encore. For 8 years, he taught engineering at the University of Cincinnati, surely their only professor who walked on the moon.
Did you ever imagine that 5 years after the first walk on the moon that we'd abandon the Apollo program?
I knew we would have a limited life, but I must say it was a bit shorter than my expectation. I fully expected that by the end of the century, we would have achieved substantially more than we actually did.
Landing, of course, there was celebration that to a great extent I don't think has ever stopped. And ever since that time, there have been people who have claimed that never happened. And imagine that, after all of the effort and all the passion, that there are still people that would say that. What was your initial response to that when I talked to you? You said something fascinating about the number of people who were involved in that project.
Well, I don't recall what I said, but people love conspiracy theories. I mean, they are very attractive to them. But it was never a concern to me because I know that one day somebody's going to go fly back up there and pick up that camera I left. So that'll be sure.
Well, look, I recall, and I think it was a fantastic response. And that was because I'm hanging off every word you say, nearly, so I remember. And it was around about the fact that 800,000 staff at NASA couldn't possibly keep a secret.
That's right.
And knowing how people work, I think that's so compelling, I can't tell you. But in that conversation as well, you alerted me to the fact that someone has put together the most marvellous combination of your landing against Google Moon mapping, which side by side clearly endorses not only that, but every crater, the flag. There's been no property development. We've just decided when we looked at the footage.
It's opportunity.
So let's just have a quick look at it.
This slide shows the trajectory to the surface. The actual power descent of the lunar module to the surface took 12 minutes and 32 seconds. And this is just the final 3 minutes, the part that's really interesting as you get close to the surface of the moon. Now, in the left screen, you will see the original 1969
movie film that we took from the window of the Lunar Module Eagle. And on the right side, you will see what the crew saw looking out the window in front of them. Now, there is a shaded area there that shows you the exact duplicate of the area that's on the left, so you can compare the craters and see if they are duplicate of each other. One on the left took place 42 years ago. This picture's on the right took place in the last 2 years. Okay, we've been descending. I should tell you, you'll hear the crewman talking. They're my co-pilot giving altitude and descent rates, and you'll hear people in the background talking from mission control on Earth. Getting down below about 70 meters now.
And down,
50 meters, still looking good. And the left side, you will see in the old movie that the rocket engine is starting to kick up some dust off the surface. And a 30-second fuel running. Need to get it down on the ground here pretty soon before we run out. Okay. The picture on the left is more accurate, but there's more dust. There you see the shadow of my landing leg coming on the surface on the blowing dust. We're very close to the surface right now.
So does that convince you that he landed? Why did he feel the need to show that clip at that meeting in Australia, which was in 2011? What about the engine noise? He's coming down onto the surface with, I don't know, 10,000 pounds of thrust, 2 feet below him. You can't hear anything. You can't hear anything. There's no rumble of the craft. Okay, I'm going to have a break in a minute. There's a few more slides in this. I guess we'd all like to be recognised for not for one piece of fireworks, but for the ledger of our daily work. That's what he said in that interview. Apollo is one piece of fireworks. Michael Collins, Apollo 11. In the press conference he said, "I don't remember seeing any stars." You can go and watch the post Apollo 11 press conference on YouTube. It's about an hour and 20 minutes or something. Watch the whole thing. Listen, watch the astronauts. See their reaction. I've got this clip of Edgar Mitchell. Again, I'm not going to play this now, but I recommend that you watch this. I assume that Edgar Mitchell was a genuine guy, but it turns out that he did actually work for the CIA in the 70s. He's involved in bringing Uri Geller over, the psychic. That was shown in a BBC documentary a couple of years ago. I've got a couple of videos on my YouTube channel about Mitchell. So he's worth looking into. I think I'm just going to go through these now. Why the hoax has not been revealed sooner? The Russians would surely have found out and blown the whistle, wouldn't they? I was talking to somebody at the interval about this. Well, it was revealed in 1999 in a BBC Horizon program that Yuri Gagarin, allegedly the first man in space, did not land in his capsule. He did not land in his capsule. Gagarin failed to follow instructions from ground control. Though told not to eject too early, he did, and from an undetermined height. Deep in the countryside, tractor driver Jacob Lysenko was working in the fields when he was astonished to see a figure descending from the sky. Can we imagine him hurtling down in this cramped capsule, opening the door, which of course is going to be, there's a lot of heat on the outside from the re-entry, inwards or outwards, and then safely jumping out? How is he going to do that? Is he really going to be able to do that? Now, I did have another clip there, but I haven't really got time to play it, so time's rolling along. And in that clip, it's revealed, this is from David Percy's film, that the Yuri Gagarin launch was halted for 45 minutes, and they claimed that there was a problem with the hatch. And they went and loosened the bolts, closed the hatch, and then resumed the countdown. Right? There was every opportunity to remove Gagarin from that capsule. That was revealed in David Peirce's documentary. So in other words, the Russians were in on the fake space program earlier than NASA were. They're all at it, they're all in it together. For the same reasons of getting money out of us for space exploration. Now more recently, a couple of things have come up, and I'll think this is the last slide in this half. In 2004, war criminal George Bush announced a new moonshot program. A return to the moon was forecast for 2020. That's 16 years later after the announcement. How's that? I mean, we've had all this technology since then. Got much more advanced digital computers, better materials. How does that work? And a NASA video that people have asked me about this recently, so I put this in. In October 2014, talks about the new Orion program and how they need to design shielding for the Van Allen zones. Eh? Didn't need to do that with Apollo. Huffington Post claims this is not proof that Apollo never went because Orion is going to linger in the Van Allen zones. If it is such an issue, why not take the same route Apollo did? Use as much similar equipment as Apollo, but updated with better materials, better electronics and so forth. Why is it harder to go to the moon now than it was in 1969 and 1970 and so forth? Of course, they just got lucky then, didn't they? 6 or 7 times in a row. And I say 7 because Apollo 13 got to the moon and then didn't land and came back. And this is still from the new NASA video that people have been going on about. This was revealed in 2009 here at Moon Rocks. You see a piece of moon rock and it's got a little caption on it. This is a moon rock. Is it really? How do you know? How would you know that that was a moon rock? August 2009, fake Dutch moon rock revealed. And apparently there's now 3 of them have been revealed as fakes as well, I've recently learned. But that was on the BBC's website, so what's the truth? And there's the plaque, given to the Dutch Museum by Armstrong, Collins and Aldrin. And Bill Clinton said, I've got the clip here, I'll just quickly read this. The old carpenter asked me, this is from Bill Clinton's autobiography, if I really believed it happened, as in the Apollo landings. I said, sure, I saw it on TV. He disagreed. He said that he didn't believe it for a minute, as in the Apollo landings, that them television fellas could make things look real that weren't. Back then, I thought he was a crank. This is Clinton talking again. During my 8 years in Washington, I saw some things on TV that made me wonder if he wasn't ahead of his time. That's in Clinton's autobiography. Now, I can't answer all the questions. People ask me these questions and I don't honestly know the answers. What were all the people in Mission Control actually watching? I don't know that. I think they were probably watching a simulation. What about the role of the dish in Australia, that film with Sam Neill from a few years ago, where they worked this radar dish, 2 guys in the outback, to get the signal from Apollo, allegedly based on a true story. What were they picking up, if not a signal from the moon? Well, they did actually have communication satellites were sent up early in the Apollo program to test the communications. They're called test and training satellites, TETRA satellites. And also the moon rock. Some people have noted that von Braun set up a mission to collect meteorites from the polar regions, which would have characteristics similar to moon rocks. What were the reasons for the hoax? Possible reason could be for hoaxing the Apollo missions. I'm nuts for suggesting it, surely. Well, here's some reasons. Those who were committed to supporting Kennedy would need to get a get-out card when they realised that Gus Grissom was right and they were not technically capable of getting to the moon. They had to have a backup plan. It took attention off the war in Vietnam, also going on at the same time. It fueled the Cold War, stoked that. It made America look good, made it look very good. And this is one that people don't often talk about. It soaked up the burgeoning interest in space travel and it made sure it was absorbed into programs which would achieve little. Only Earth orbit for manned flight, which is all that has been repeated since. Since Apollo, no one has been beyond low Earth orbit, LEO. No one. Apart from, manned programs, of course. And there was money for black programs, which we're going to come back to in part 2. Secret, unacknowledged programs that nobody, not even people in government, know about. It was an experiment in social engineering. It was a great to try out, It was a great triumph for using TV power to make people believe a huge lie, because television was still in its infancy then. The high created then can now be played off against the low created now, when people would discover it was a hoax. This is a kind of conscious energy extraction process. I'm not really going to talk about that much. I think there's an element of that. You've just been messed with. You've been messed with your mind. Somebody is benefiting from that. There are mucky fingerprints all over the Apollo record. A trail of fakery, possible murder, lies and deception seems to be apparent if you look at all this evidence. I've only touched on it briefly in this presentation in the hour and a bit we've done. The lunar rover, I think, shows up some of the most glaring difficulties in our Apollo, in the Apollo record. They couldn't have got that there in the way that they claim. We only seem to have a few photos or video sequences where the astronauts are clearly recognisable on the moon. We haven't got a picture where you can actually see Armstrong's face on the moon, or Aldrin's, or any of the others. The only one that I came across was somebody that you probably don't know. In other words, you don't know Jack Schmidt. It's kind of a pun there, but there you go. Okay. We don't have enough evidence to conclude whether the named astronauts or other astronauts went to the moon using more advanced technology. That's one that I get asked sometimes. Did they go to the moon but using some type of advanced anti-gravity craft or something like that? I don't know. I don't think they did, but I can't rule it out because I don't have enough evidence to say one way or the other. Yeah, I've given those other reasons. So for the rest of that, if you want to follow this up, look at Dark Moon, David Percy and Mary Bennett's book. Orlis.com is a good site. NASA Moon America, you can get that online, a free PDF, Ralph Rene. Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Moon, that's on YouTube as well. Astronauts Gone Wild, that's an essential one, that. Was It Only a Paper Moon? Did We Go to the Moon? That's quite good. Dark Side of the Moon, which is really a strange documentary. Apollo Zero, that's free at ApolloZero.com. And Moon Faker. Okay, so I think that's it for the first half. I've got books and DVDs over there. I don't make any money out of these. DVDs 50 pence, booklets 50 pence. The paperbacks, you can ask me for the price because they're different. But I really don't make any money off these. I just cover my costs so that I can do events like this. So thank you very much for listening to the first half. So we'll have a break, maybe 20 minutes, half an hour, and then come back for maybe another hour or so. Thank you very much.